style as Paul's A Bard's Eye View series continues. He speaks with poet William Patrick, whose latest book is called We Didn't Come Here for This, A Memoir in Poetry.
You have screenplays both on American television and the BBC and four books of poetry. With that background, I'm thinking Gerald Brennan has described poetry as resulting from a struggle in the poet's mind between something he or she wants to say and the medium in which they're trying to say it. You could just as easily, or perhaps even more easily, have chosen to write a prose memoir or a fictional novel in the style of a memoir. So why poetry?
Well, at the time that I wrote this, which was about halfway through 1997 up through halfway through 1998, I was reading a lot of the same memoirs that everybody was reading. I was reading Angela's Ashes and The Liar's Club by Mary Carr and This Boy's Life and Richard Seltzer's Down from Troy, all terrific prose memoirs. And as I was reading them, part of me just wanted to do something different. I wanted to do a memoir that hadn't been done before. So part of me said, well, I'll do it in poetry. But not regular lyrical poetry. I wanted to do narrative poetry, dramatic poetry. And part of that is the same thing I've done in my other books. I like hybrid forms. I like mixing things up. Some prose, some poetry. And I did a little of that in here, too.
I'll say.
But I also wanted to do something else. I wanted a memoir that had a different narrative distance than the prose memoirs I was reading. And I loved all those books. They're all terrific books. I mean, really, the last 10 or 12 years have given us all these terrific memoirs. But the problem with a prose memoir, like all novels, is that it's about accretion of detail. And there's also that distance between the writer and the reader. And I thought, well, how do I break down that distance? How do I not be that narrative voice explaining everything about my life to the reader? And I thought, well, poetry, if it's dramatic, if it's narrative, if it recreates that particular moment, and if I do it in voices, if I'm not just myself, but I'm my father, if I'm my mother, if I'm this sort of unnamed narrator, this omniscient narrator out there, well, then maybe I can recreate the moment. And that'll make it much easier for the reader to enter that moment.
You've sort of almost answered the next question I was going to ask you. Ellen Glasgow, the writer, once told an interviewer that she chose to write fiction because the things she imagined were more vital and vivid to her than the things she remembered. You've taken what some might characterize as mundane sequences in the lives of ordinary people as the substance of this memoir, and you've ennobled them. Now, was the design of this book, with using photographs and, you know, and the poems, was this fixed in your mind from the beginning?
No, it wasn't. I really didn't know what I was going to do with this book. I was in the middle of working on the book that I'm just finishing now, which is a book about a year I spent riding with the Troy Fire Department. It's called Saving Troy. And I didn't know how to do it. I was completely clueless about how to do it. I had done it one way, including myself as a character, and it just wasn't working. And so I kind of whacked away at it for month after month, and finally, in despair, kind of gave up, but needed to write something. I needed to feel like I could write again. I needed to feel a little successful. So I took material that I'd been using for many, many years, family material, and instead of dealing with it finding kind of objective correlatives, finding other situations that would serve my emotional needs in dealing with this family material, I thought, well, I'll just talk about my family. I'll actually do a memoir. Mm-hmm. Everybody else is doing them. I'll do one. But that set up some other problems because I had never really spoken in my voice before. I had always found other voices to speak in. And I also, like everybody else, had a lot of mixed feelings about my family. That's the interesting thing about memoir. We all have lots of family photographs. We all have, of course, our own stories about families. We all have our own very disparate emotions. And I didn't really want to hurt a lot of people. And there are a lot of family secrets in this book that I had to talk about. I had to deal with. And they did hurt some people. You know, my father especially got very upset at some of the things that were revealed in this book. But that wasn't why I did it. I did it to re-explore my childhood and to find out what happened back there. So I came up with the notion that I would become these people.
Ernest Hemingway once noted that a writer who lacks a sense of justice and of injustice would be better off editing high school yearbooks. I'm thinking that in working on this book, you were laboring under a sort of double whammy, as it were, because the book reprises childhood when one often has an exaggerated view of what's just and unjust. But childhood's also a time of rebellion. And you're still somewhat of a literary rebel. So did this seeming dichotomy generate any problems for you?
The literary rebel side really just means that I want to do something new all the time. And Ezra Pound, of course, said, make it new, way before Ernest Hemingway. And I've always kind of gone by that maxim. You got to make it new. And that means form, content, everything. So I didn't think I was feeling terribly rebellious. I was feeling like I wanted to make something that people hadn't seen, especially with a memoir. In terms of justice, boy, that's a whole different can of worms there. Because all of us, when we reach adulthood, look back on our childhoods and think, well, who would I like to get back for this particular thing? And, you know, a lot of people use memoirs that way. They use them as a way to get back at people.
Sure.
And although I think my father and his wife currently feel like I used this to get back at them.
That really wasn't your purpose.
I was absolutely not intending to do that at all. I was trying to give all the characters in here as much fullness, as much three-dimensionality as I could. And it really wasn't about justice for me. Although there's a different kind of justice in the poem.
Right. And the poem I'm thinking about, of course, is the one Jim and Jimmy at 304 Hoosick Street, Troy, in June of 1948. And it's all about how a kid feels, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, I think in this case, the new father, Jim, in 1948 is a new father. He's really just had this baby a few months earlier. And strangely enough, he's not feeling much like a father. In one sense, he is, because he wants to raise this new baby sort of as a spitting image of himself and be a guide and a mentor for the child. But he's so mired in his own reactions to his own father still and his own unresolved childhood that I think if we hear any child's cry in this poem, it's his cry, because the whole poem ends up being about his father.
Mm.
Let me just give one quick little lead-in here. It's 2 years or a year and a half into the marriage, and the marriage is not going terribly well at this point. Jim is working for his father, who's been gambling away his commission money and not paying him very well. And he's getting already estranged from his wife, so there's already some problems. And the poem opens with him sort of having a fight with his wife. He's bathing his new son, and the kid's afraid of water. And he, you know, instead of respecting that in any way, he just keeps him down in there screaming and keeps talking. So here's the poem. Some things you can't explain to women. He's afraid, Betty hollered a couple of times before I set her straight. I let you baptize him, I yelled back. Now let me teach him what I want. Jimmy wouldn't quit squirming and screaming and just sit there in his tub. And I was going slow, too. Lowered his feet in a little bit, splashed some on his belly. He's a baby. He's afraid of the water. Jesus, that's the point. What is there to be afraid of here? No boy named after me will be afraid. James Knox Patrick III, named after me after my father, and him after his uncle. Born on the day James Knox Polk was inaugurated our 11th president, 4th day of March, 1845. Jimmy cried when the priest spilled the holy water on his head, and nobody hollered at him. You have to edge fear out early and substitute toughness. I was scared to death of my father, because I knew how tough he was. He had only half a right foot, and he suffered that his whole life. He grew up in Mechanicville and had to catch a train to Albany to get to college down there. Well, one morning, in winter, he had a nosebleed and was late. He jumped at the last train car, missed, and it took off his foot, squared his shoe straight across. The doctors couldn't sew it back on, not in 1913, so they stitched the skin over and left him a stump. And he wore a stump sock, heavy fabric to cover the wound, pulled all the way up to the knee. But here's how tough he was. The stump sock rubbed against an artificial foot made of leather every time he took a step. For 20 years, the front of that stump never healed. He walked on an open sore. And every morning, my mother had to lay a new dressing on it. Fixing his foot, she called it. She took balsam Peru, spread it on gauze, and then taped that both ways to cover the wound. In winter, she held the bottle with pliers above the gas flame to coax it out of the bottle. If it weren't for bowling, he'd be walking on that open sore still. In 1933, my mother went to a tournament, the ABC, in California. She drove all the way with four other women and told me I had to fix my father's foot. But when the cat's away, you know. And the first morning, he was hungover, and it was cold. We lived at 111 Second Avenue, right on the Hudson River. Our backyard in February was the frozen water, and the wind tore across something wicked. Our bedrooms faced out back, and the balsam Peru was frozen. "Get out of here," he said. "I gotta do it. Mother'll kill me," I said. "Get lost or I'll kill you." 2 weeks, we didn't touch his foot. And you know what happened? It scabbed over. She was keeping it soft with a salve, cleaning out the bacteria it needed, and it couldn't heal itself. Some things you just can't explain to women, no matter what. She was mad as hell at me when she got home, even after she saw it was better. My father, he was big, 6 feet and 2'10" at least, like his father, who they called the strongest man in Mechanicville. When he worked for the railroad, the story went that he once lifted the two wheels and axle of a railroad car, 2,000 pounds, a couple of inches off the ground. But my father beat my mother, knelt on her shoulders, punched her in the face, even with me grabbing at him and shouting lots of times. Maybe with that salve, she wanted to slow him down. After the foot, he got ulcers, and they made him even meaner. He used a cat of nine tails on me. It was wood with leather strips, and it hung on a nail in the kitchen, to be pointed over at or taken down and swung. My first memory of him using it was at Christmas time. I was little, like three, and they were gone, he and my mother, to some party somewhere. They left me with a babysitter, so I grabbed a limb and pulled down our Christmas tree, busted all my mother's lovely ornaments. I guess the babysitter didn't grab me soon enough. I'll never forget when my father came home and got down the cat and nine tails. That's the first strong memory I have of him. But I don't blame him. My father's meanness saved my life. When I was 8, I walked up to 103rd Street, where the houses turned to fields. A set of stone stairs led down to the river there. I found a rowboat, unhooked it, and rowed out where the current rushed down toward the Ford Motor Dam at Bond Street. Somebody spotted me pretty quick, and the cops reached me in a boat. But my father wasn't there. He had them haul me away, up to the police station in North Troy, and put me in a cell. Jesus, I was terrified then. He came up after a few hours, and they took me in front of a judge. "What should I do with him?" my father asked the judge, and he said, "Take him home now, but if he goes on that river, bring him back. We'll throw him back in the cell and lose the key." Then he dragged me home and took down the cat and nine tails again. He was clever. He was. I didn't go near that river. And I could feel those cops' eyes burning a hole right in my back whenever I was outdoors. My first son, I love you. I know what I want for you. But you have to be tough. Yourself. The world is what it is. We can't wish away all the trouble. I wish I could go back and yell to that train conductor, have him hold the morning train for one extra minute, or have my babysitter catch that goddamn Christmas tree. But I know I can't do either one. We're all bound to get hurt. That's the truth of it. Your mother grew up rich, in a warm house for the winter. She wants it all to be easy, but I know better.
The title of the book, We Didn't Come Here for This, A Memoir in Poetry, by our guest, William Patrick.
William Patrick's latest book, again, We Didn't Come Here for This. It's published by BOA Editions Limited. Patrick will be reading from his book for the Siena College Gray Friar Series this Thursday morning, October 10th, on the campus of Siena College in Loudonville, New York.